We're going to start a new study in the life of Moses. Moses, probably one of the most important Old Testament characters, probably one of the most well-known individuals in the entire Word of God, somebody that's really important, really, he's kind of to the Old Testament what Jesus is to the New Testament. Everything kind of, you know, points to Moses, but don't want to put him on the same level, of course, with Christ. But in many ways, he's almost a type of Christ in the Old Testament. He's the deliverer. He's the one that delivered God's people from the bondage that was in Egypt and so forth. And he was the lawgiver. It's interesting that in the New Testament, there are more references to Moses than any other person in the Old Testament. He's referred to in the New Testament some 79 times. Second to Moses in references in the New Testament is Abraham, and he's referred to about 74 times. Doesn't come too far behind Moses, but he's a few behind. And really, Moses is one of the most important biblical characters that you could ever study. Moses was the one who was appearing there on Mount Transfiguration with Elijah, the prophet, when Jesus was transfigured in the New Testament. Moses was the one that the religious leaders in the time of Jesus kept pointing back to, our Father Moses, our Father Moses. They put so much faith and stock in this man. What a great man. And really, I am personally excited to study his life. It's going to take us several weeks, probably a couple, two or three months, to study the life of Moses because the Bible has so much to say about him. But he's a man that was for sure mightily used of God. He was a man that was an instrument in the hand of God. And tonight we're going to see the early upbringing of Moses, and we're going to see those years of preparation, how God was preparing a man for a ministry. I believe that God, every time he has something for us to do, he has to first of all start in our hearts and lives and working in us, preparing us for that ministry. So often, the minute we get saved, you know, we want to be out and we want to be Billy Graham overnight or something. But God has his processes. He wants to work in our hearts and work in our lives. And so what a fantastic lesson we learned from Moses as God was working in his life and shaping and molding his character, developing him into the man he wanted to use, and then ultimately using him in such a mighty way, leading all those people for the 40 years in the wilderness, such a dynamic leader and so forth. What a powerful man we have in the life of, example we have in the life of Moses. Now, we left off several weeks ago with the death of Joseph in Egypt. Now, the children of Israel had gotten into Egypt because of the famine in the land. Joseph had been sold by his brothers into Egypt, and his brothers had to go down to buy corn and so forth so that they might make it through the famine. Joseph revealed himself, said, go get dad and mom and, you know, and bring them on down to Egypt, and I'll take care of you here. And so everyone had gone down into Egypt. Well, Jacob had died. Finally, Joseph had died. And the problem was they were all there in Egypt. And after several years after the death of Joseph, to be exact, some about 300 years, there was a Pharaoh that came on the scene that didn't know Joseph. He wasn't really friendly to the children of Israel. And so he started to really deal severely with them, started using them for slaves. And so from the end of Genesis, from chapter 50, verse 26, to Exodus chapter 1, verse 1, there is almost no gap there as far as the text is concerned. Now, there's a time gap of about 300 years where we pass in silence, but really, you can step from Genesis right into Exodus almost without missing a beat. It closes and it says, and so Joseph died, that is Genesis 50:26, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and they put him in a coffin in Egypt. Now, and in some translations it's and, these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man with his household came with Jacob. There was Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Ashkar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. These were the 12 tribes, which were the 12 sons of Jacob who came into Egypt. All the souls, verse 5, that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all the generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly. And they multiplied, they waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. I kind of like that, you know. Filled with Israelites, you know. Boom, they were popping out all over the place. Fruitful people. Now, they went into Egypt, 70 souls. And some 400 years later, in the Exodus, when they leave, they leave some 200 million strong. And so in 400 years, they'd multiply just about that rapidly, which is amazing that they would multiply so rapidly. It was really the hand of God upon them. God was working to fulfill his promises. You remember that God told Abraham back in the 15th chapter of Genesis, where he had promised the covenant to Abraham, but then he told Abraham that thy seed was going to go into a strange land, and they were going to be strangers for 400 something years. But then God promised that ultimately that he would deliver them and lead them out. Remember, Abraham made the covenant. He cut up the animals into little pieces, and there was the smoking lamp that passed in between and the darkness that came over. God was prophesying of actually the 400 years of darkness and servitude that his seed would go through. But then God promised that he would bring them out and that he would lead them into the land of milk and honey. And so the Exodus stood as one of the greatest pinnacles in the Old Testament, a sign of God's power to deliver. And the children of Israel always pointed back to the Exodus, the Passover, and so forth. It was one of the most important things in the history of the Jew. That was the great going out. That's what the word Exodus means, the going out, the leaving that bondage and servitude. So they had multiplied greatly, but in verse 8, it says that there rose up a new king over Egypt, which did not know Joseph. Now the Pharaoh that existed at this time is uncertain. Some say it's Ramesses II. And some say there's other pharaohs that were more likely to be the pharaohs at this time. And so it's really kind of a controversy, and we really don't know who the pharaoh was. But this wasn't the pharaoh that Joseph had the favorable relationships with. And so he said unto his people, verse 9, behold, the people of the children of Israel, they are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, that they join also our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Now Pharaoh realized, hey, these people are multiplying so fast, and they're more and mightier now than us, that if we have a war, and these guys decide to enlist in the army of our enemy and fight against us, we're goners. So let's get these people out of here before they wipe us out. And so they set taskmasters over them, and they began to make them servants. It says, therefore they did set, verse 11, over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasures of the city of Pithom and Ramesses. Now this is the time of Egypt in its height of glory. You had the, what are those things that go up to the point, you know, the pyramids, all right. You're on the ball tonight. They had the pyramids, they had all the, you know, the big statues of Ramesses and all these big things in the Nile. And it was just really Egypt in its height of glory. And it was all built by slave labor. And they were using the Israelites in order to accomplish their purposes. But it says, verse 12, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. You can't stop these people. Can't stop God's people. It's kind of like in the book of Acts, the more they persecuted the Christians, the more the church grew. Persecution has never harmed the church. So many people are afraid today that, oh, we're maybe in due for persecution here in the United States. Well, I don't favor persecution, and I'm not praying that God would send persecution, but I'm not afraid that the church is going to be stamped out. Jesus said that the gates of hell would never prevail against it. And I don't care what enemy forces come in, the church is always going to grow and prevail because it's the church of the living God. Nobody can stop God, and it's God's church, and he's doing his work. And so the children of Israel were growing and multiplying, and the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them to serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, which the name of the one was Sapphira, and the name of the other one was Pua, neat name. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, and if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, and if it be a daughter, then shall she live. But the midwives, verse 17, feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the maidwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the maidwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, they are lively. And they deliver just the minute before we can get into the maidwives come in unto them, they've had their babies. Therefore God dealt well with the maidwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. Now, Pharaoh was attempting to annihilate all the male babies. He figured, wow, they're multiplying and growing so fast. Now, the girl babies, the female babies, they could marry other Egyptian men and kind of mingle into their culture. And they were kind of usable, but not the men. The men would marry other Israelite women and they would multiply and have their children. And so he was seeking to eradicate all the male babies. It was almost like the same setting when Jesus was born. When Jesus was born, Herod sought to slay all the male babies so that he might not be able to live. You almost see kind of a same thing there. Now, it's interesting that God's hand is on the situation. God is going to accomplish his purposes. Bad times require, like I said, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, good men. When times get really bad, we need good men. We need men who will rise up and do God's bidding. And so times were bad, times were dire. They were the dark ages for the children of Israel. And they needed somebody to lead them out. They needed a deliverer. And so God was working to accomplish his purposes. Now, had Pharaoh not gone about and done this kind of a program, as we're going to see the story unfold, Salmane, who was Moses' mother, she would have never been, you know, forced to take Moses and hide him in the bulrushes. Pharaoh's daughter would have never found him, taken him into his house. He never would have been prepared for his ministry, and all God's purposes would have never been accomplished. In the natural, you look at that and you go, oh no, this is terrible. But in reality, God was putting the pieces of the puzzle all together in order to bring about his purposes, and so God's hand was on the whole thing. So it says in verse 21 that it came to pass, because the maidwives feared God, then he made them houses, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter that you shall save alive. And so this was what the decree was of Pharaoh at this time. This was the situation. This was the dark time when God's man came on the scene, the man Moses. Now it says in chapter 2, verse 1, that there went a man of the house of Levi, and he took a wife of the daughter of Levi. Now this man is told us in chapter 6 of Exodus, verse 20, that his name is Aaron. And that was the father of Moses. And this woman that he took here to wife, the daughter of Levi, was Jochebed, who was the mother of Moses. This was Moses' father and mother. And so they were both of the tribe of Levi. Levi was going to be, of course, through Aaron, where the high priest would come. And so they come together. Now, at this time, they already had two children. It says in verse 2 that the woman, that is Jochebed, conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Now, Moses was probably, and this is just a little speculation, we don't know for sure, but it seems as though Moses was the youngest child in the family, as far as the scriptures record. Miriam seems to be the oldest sister. Aaron was a little younger than Miriam, probably, and then Moses was like the little brother, the little squirt, you know. The fact that Miriam was still there and she was watching in the bulrushes when he was put out on the Nile, she was there watching over him. And Aaron was on the scene at the same time. He seemed to be an older brother. And so Moses was born at this time. Now, I'm sure that even as at the same time when Jesus was born, as much as the Israelite women, they were looking to give birth to a male child who would ultimately be the deliverer, the Messiah. So at this time, the women were looking, you know, to really give birth to a son that would bring a promise to the nation Israel, possibly be the deliverer. And so I'm sure Jochebed was really excited when she had a son. And it says concerning this son, in verse 2, that he was a goodly child, and so she hid him 3 months. Now, in Acts, the 7th chapter, the 20th verse, Stephen, when he's giving his speech before the Sanhedrin, and Stephen gives a beautiful history of the whole children of Israel, and especially zooms in on the life of Moses, and it would be neat to go to it and really go back and forth, but we don't have the time to go into Stephen's speech, but Stephen refers to Moses quite a bit in a sermon in the 7th chapter of Acts, and he gives us little nidbits and little commentaries and insights that we don't get in Exodus. And Stephen, in chapter 7, verse 20, tells us that Moses, when he was born, was exceeding fair before God or to God. And it would seem as though that the baby, when he was born, almost, you know, it was just kind of like, I hate to use the words, but I'll go ahead and use it. You get the vibes from this kid, you know, that the Lord was going to use him. You know, I hate to sound mystical or anything. But you just looked at the kid, you know, and maybe he even glowed or something. I don't know, you know. He not only was handsome and good looking, but he was, you know, just fair to God. He just seemed like, hey, you know, God's really going to use this. Now, you can tell that probably Jochebed was a very God-fearing woman. And probably in Moses' early years, those first 3 years, as we're going to see when she had him, she probably taught him as much as she could get in his little mind about the things of God and Jehovah was God and so forth. And so she was probably really a woman that feared the Lord and really looking for the deliverer to come. And when she saw this child, maybe God just spoke to her heart or bore witness to her heart that, hey, this is the deliverer. This is the one that's going to lead my people out of the bondage here in Egypt. And so Stephen referred to him as fair to God. And so Moses was very fair. A lot of tradition says that Moses was a very good-looking man. And the Apocrypha books refer to him as being good-looking. He walked down the street, you know, everybody would turn their heads and check him out. You know, Charlton Heston, you know. And he would go by and everyone was looking at him because he was so good-looking. So she hid him 3 months, but after the end of 3 months, she couldn't hide him in the house any longer. And so when she could not hide him any longer, verse 3, she took for him an ark, or a little basket of bulrushes, and she dubbed him with slime and with pitch, and she put the child therein, and she laid it with flags on the river's brink. This is actually just taking the bulrushes that were along the side of the river and forming a little ark or a little boat. It's the same word in the Hebrew used ark for the ark that Noah got in with all the animals and so forth that God saved them in the flood. And so they were in, Moses was put in this little basket, this little boat. Now this is a story that's, you know, blessed the hearts of people, you know, for years. In Sunday school you've heard the story, and you know, little Moses, the baby, put in the bulrushes and so forth. And it's a really touching story. But there's also a lot of really profound spiritual truth that we can glean from this touching little story here. Now, it tells us in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, Moses is mentioned several times in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, as a man of faith. You think of Abraham, the man of faith, but actually Moses is mentioned more times in Hebrews 11 than Abraham is. And he's mentioned as a man of faith, and it tells us in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, that by faith, when Moses was born, was hid by his mother. Now, really, it wasn't Moses' faith that hid him in the bulrushes, it was the faith of his mother. You know, the kid was just born. He didn't say, Mom, I've got faith in God, stick me in a basket, you know, and stick me. It wasn't his faith, it was his parents' faith. And so Jochebed displays a great faith in God. It took a lot of faith. I don't think I could handle taking my little baby, you know, my little girl, and putting her in a little basket and floating her out on the, you know, Fifth Street Lake or something, you know. Oh, God, send somebody just to save her, you know. That'd be a really heavy thing, put your kid out on the lake and just pray that God would send somebody by to rescue him. But I'm sure that this was a thing that was God-led and something that Jochebed had a great deal of faith to do, even as the writer in Hebrews chapter 11 brings it out, that he was by faith hid by his parents because that Pharaoh was taking the lives of those who were born, the male babies. But it says in verse 4 that his sister stood afar off to wit or to see what would be done to him. And so Jochebed probably told Miriam, well, you stand over in the bulrushes and you kind of just spy him out and keep an eye on him and see what's going to happen to him. And so the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she set her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. What a coincidence, wept just at that perfect moment, you know. Just as Pharaoh's daughter was opening up the basket, wah, you know. I'm sure Jochebed said, now, right when she opens it, you cry, Moses. Now, whether or not Jochebed put him purposely in the place where she knew Pharaoh's daughter was going to take a bath, we don't know. The scripture doesn't say. But it's possible that she knew this was an area where Pharaoh's daughter would go, and so she would put him purposely right in this area. It's possible. But it was the hand of God that this little baby would cry just at the precise moment in order that that cry would pierce into the heart of Pharaoh's daughter and she would be touched. You know, what person wouldn't be touched finding a little baby opening the basket and starts crying right when you look at it? I mean, oh, wow, that's heavy. But you know, such what seemingly would be such a light and insignificant thing, a little cry, changed the whole course of history for the children of Israel. That little cry went into the heart of Pharaoh's daughter, and so she took Moses into her house. and she trained him and raised him and so forth. But when she opened the basket, behold, the babe wept, and she had compassion on him, and she said, ah, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister unto Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and shall I call a nurse for thee of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called her mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee wages. And the woman took the child, and she nursed it. Now, how beautiful is the program of God? How beautiful is the plan of God unfolding here? Jochebed back there praying, oh God, watch over my son, preserve him, and take care of him. She launches him out on the Nile, and the next thing she knows is that she's getting paid to take care of her own son. I think God's interested in economy even. This is pretty good. How'd you mothers like to get paid to take care of your own baby? I mean, that'd be just fantastic. God worked it out so that she could get paid and taken care of her own. She knew one day she'd have to give him back, but she also knew that he would be taken care of, that he wouldn't be wiped out. Pharaoh's daughter wouldn't have him killed. And so Miriam ran up on the scene and says, you want me to get somebody? Sure, and she went and got, of course, got her mother. And so she came and she nursed Moses. Now, how long she had him, we really don't know, but the most commentators, Edersheim says that it was usually about 3 years that the Hebrew women would nurse their children. They would wean them at about 3 years old. Of course, today in our culture, we don't nurse children that old. But they would wean them at about 3 years old. And so those were the 3 years that Jochebed had with her little son, Moses. And in those 3 years, I'm sure that she took a lot of attention and effort to try to communicate to him the things and the love of God. And that she took his little body and put it up on her knee and communicated to him that Jehovah was God and that he was a child of God and that we are God's people, and began to share with him the things of God. And it is amazing that in the first 3 years of life, how impressionable the little person is, that really that you could communicate to them at such a young age principles and teaching and so forth that would last throughout a lifetime. And it's even said by many people today that, you know, study the younger generation, that in the first 3 years of life, or the first 5 years or so, are though the real impressionable years. And those are the years when you really got to love them and communicate to them, because you can set a pattern for them in those first few years that will last throughout a lifetime. So it would seem that Jochebed really communicated the things of God to Moses, even though she had him only 3 years, that actually for this lifetime it would send him on the right path and it would direct him in the right way. And so Jochebed had her son Moses, and she was nursing him and taking care of him. And we're going to see, I believe, that this had an influence on him 40 years later when he had to come to a decision, when he had to make a decision as to follow God or to identify with the people of the world. And so it says, verse 10, that the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and he called his name Moses. She called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. Now, Moses means drawn out. Now, I'm sure Jochebed gave him a Hebrew name, but Pharaoh's daughter gave him this Egyptian name, which means drawn out, because she drew him out of the Nile River. Now, this is a division point in the life of Moses. And we're going to see that the life of Moses divides into three categories. He lived to be 120 years old. And you can divide perfectly the life of Moses into three 40-year periods. And the first 40 years of Moses were spent, of course, in Pharaoh's court, being the son of Pharaoh's daughter. The second 40-year gamut of Moses' life was spent in the wilderness of Midian, herding sheep. There at the end of that 40 years, God came to him in a burning bush and called him to go deliver his people. The last 40 years of the life of Moses were spent wandering around in the wilderness. And so the 40 years in Pharaoh's court, 40 years in the desert of Midian, and then 40 years in the desert around the Sinai, the same area that he was in Midian, not herding sheep, but this time herding people. Someone said he was 40 years in Pharaoh's court becoming something, 40 years in the wilderness becoming nothing, and another 40 years God showing that he could take something, make it nothing, and then use it for himself and for his glory. That he could take nothing and use it for his glory. Next week, as we get the call of Moses, when God comes to Moses, Moses says, Lord, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and tell him to release the people of God? And so the four sets of Moses' life, we're going to get the first 80 years of Moses' life tonight, because the first 80 years are kind of passed over quickly. It's the last 40 years that God really gets into detail on all the wanderings of the children of Israel. Now, between verses 10 and 11, we have kind of a jump into the next 40 years. From verses 1 to 10, that's the first 40 years of the life of Moses. Pretty fantastic that he could get 40 years old in only 10 verses, huh? And so you see that God doesn't give all the details of the training and the upbringing of this man. But going back to Stephen's sermon, not turning there, but just referring to it, Stephen said that Moses was learned in all the schools and all the wisdom of Egypt. Now, Egypt was very prominent for all their educational system and for their learning at this time. A very learned people. They would learn science and botany and astrology and just everything you could name, mathematics and hieroglyphics and all these things. So Moses was being schooled in this. He never would have got that kind of schooling if he would have stayed at home with his mom and dad. Now, God was preparing a man for the ministry. He was learning how to write. He was learning all these trades and all these abilities. Moses was the one who wrote the first five books of the Bible. And so God is preparing this man for his ministry. And so he was schooled in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And so this was the first 40 years of his life. But when we go into verse 11, Moses was coming to the place of decision. Moses was coming to the place, being a Hebrew, where he had to decide, am I going to stay here in Pharaoh's court, or am I going to be identified with the people of God? What should I do? And I think you know well what Moses decided to do. So it came to pass that in those days that Moses was grown, 40 years old, that he went out unto his brother, and he looked on their burdens, and he espied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brothers. Now the Egyptians were really treating them terribly. And when it says smiting here, it means they were just whipping them and beating them and putting them through all kinds of rigor and torture. And so it says in verse 12 that he looked this way and he looked that way. And when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and he hid him in the sand. That is, not he didn't hide himself, he hid the dead Egyptian in the sand. Moses commits murder. And really, that's exactly what it is. Now it says in verse 12 that he looked this way and he looked that way, but he forgot to look up. He didn't see any man, but he forgot that God was really looking. Now in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, there of course is a beautiful commentary on Moses at this point in his life. And we're going to have to stop here and turn over to Hebrews. Don't lose your place in Genesis, but look over with me in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. We'll find a commentary on Moses and the decision that he had to make at this point in his life. And this is one of my favorite portions of scriptures in the New Testament because it's so practical. It's a thing that we all have to go through. Now, Moses was 40 years old. He'd learned everything that the world had to offer. He'd had everything in his fingertips, everything that he could ever want there in the court of Pharaoh. Now, we might want to back up to verse 23 and read the verse that I mentioned. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw that he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. That was the faith of Moses' parents. But for Moses, verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. When he was 40 years old, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of reward. And by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. What a fantastic decision Moses made. Moses, when he was come to years, by faith, it says in verse 24. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Believe me, it took a lot of faith for Moses to say bye-bye Pharaoh's court and to go out and to identify himself with the people of God. That's faith. But the Bible tells us in the New Testament that without faith, it's impossible to please God. And the just have to live by faith. We put our faith and trust in Jesus for salvation, and we have to live a life of faith. And so we have to identify ourselves here with Moses. We have to choose. Everyone has to come to that point. Now notice it tells us in verse 25 that it was a choosing. It doesn't say it was a refusing. It wasn't kind of a negative, passive kind of thing where Moses just refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter or partake of the sins there in Egypt. But it was a positive thing where he made a choice to turn and leave Egypt and to be identified with the people of God. Everyone has to make that choice. So many people try to make it kind of a passive thing. They try to go through life, well, I'm sorry, I don't do that and I don't do that. And they try just not to partake of sins. I don't get involved there, excuse me, you know. But they never make a positive choosing for the things of God. They just try to take a kind of a refusal stand. No, I don't do that. Instead of making a choosing. And so Moses, not just refusing, but choosing to go all the way. And the question you should ask yourself tonight, have you made that choice? Have you decided, not just to, you know, abstain, but have you decided to go full on? Have you jumped completely into the river? Have you just given yourself completely? And so Moses choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Now the thing was, you might say, on one hand, Moses had all that Egypt had to offer. All the glory, all the pomp, all the riches, all the wealth. And in the other hand, he had identification with the people of God. He had the suffering, the persecution, the reproach that he would have to bear. And when comparing them both together, comparing the best that the world had to offer against the worst that God had to offer, Moses chose the worst that God had to offer. What would you have done? Would you have grabbed at the immediate advantage? I said, well, the things of God are nice, but that's for in the sweet by and by, the pie in the sky kind of a thing. I mean, I want to live it up now in Egypt land, you know. I've got it together here. But Moses really had the long range effect in mind. He had the end in mind. It's a foolish man will always grab at the immediate advantage and won't consider what will happen when I bite into that bait. What will happen? Well, I might be in somebody's frying pan next week or something, you know. And so Moses took the long-range terms in mind, and he considered the reproaches of Christ, greater riches than the treasures, all the gold and all the splendor that were in Egypt, just to be identified with the people of God, because he endured to seeing him who was invisible. The Bible says that our light afflictions work for us but a moment of, you know, glory that we shall yet be ushered into. For we look not at the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. The things that are seen are temporal. The things that are unseen, those are the eternal things. A better lot to choose for the things of God. And so Moses chose to be identified with the people of God, then to enjoy the pleasures of sin for the season. Now, sin is pleasurable, and he could have partaken, but yet he chose to follow the things of God. Now, it could be that in those 3 years of his first 3 years of life, that Jacob had instilled in him such principles of faith and trust in God, that they stuck with him when he came to this point of making this decision. Parents, so important, train up your children in the way of the Lord. The Bible says when they're old, they'll not depart from that path. Give yourself diligently to training, to disciplining, and to loving and nurturing your children in the fear of God. You never know what kind of a decision that might hinge upon, that they might have to make in latter years. And so Moses chose to be identified with the people of God. Turning back now to the book of Genesis, or Exodus, excuse me, the second chapter, when he was come to that place of decision, he decided to identify himself with the people of God, and he looked out, as it tells us in verses 11 and 12, and he saw an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew. Now his heart was burning within him, stirred to deliver his people. I believe, in light of Stephen's sermon in Acts 7, that Moses felt in his heart that God had indeed called him to be a deliverer. But what we see here in Moses' experience was he was trying to fulfill a divine spiritual call of God in the energy of the flesh. He was trying to fulfill a spiritual ends by a carnal means. God had called him. That's glorious. But God's calling is also involved with God's timing. And it wasn't God's time for the children of Israel to be delivered. Now Moses, in a sense, in the energy of the flesh, had just rolled up his sleeves, said, "Oh, stand back, God, I can take care of it myself." And he went out and buried one Egyptian. And thinking that, you know, he was called to be the mightier deliverer. But look what happened. It says that when he was went out the second day after he had done this, verse 13, behold, two men, they were Hebrews, strove together, and they said to him that did wrong the other one, "Wherefore do you smite your fellow?" He says, "Your brothers, what are you doing?" And he said, they said to Moses, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." And when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. Blew up in his face. "Stand back, God, here I go, you know, I'm going to deliver your people." God was just going, "Oh no, I don't want to watch." And so it all fell in on him. Moses thought he was going to deliver his people. God was going to use him to deliver his people, but it wasn't his timing yet. And so you might feel God calling you to a certain ministry. Great. But wait for God's timing. And wait for God's empowering. Remember last week, Peter and John fishing on the Sea of Galilee? And they were toiling all night. Jesus told them they were supposed to be waiting for him. They weren't obeying what God had said. And they toiled all night, caught no fish. Jesus comes on the scene the next morning, says, "Hey, throw your nets on the other side." They throw their nets on the other side and they pull in the nets. They had all more fish than they could even handle. One was in the energy of the flesh, doing in disobedience on their own, and the other was being directed divinely by God. And the result was fruitfulness. Your ministry becomes fruitful when it's directed by God. And so here Moses, kind of all impatient, he's kind of like Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus was about to be apprehended, whipped out the sword and took off the guy's ear. Impulsiveness. And Jesus said, "Peter, just put up your sword, cool it. It's not time. There'll be a day I'll come back in power and great glory with the sword that cometh out of my mouth, but this isn't the time." Peter was just going to defend the Lord for him, you know. "Lord, I know you can call 10,000 angels, but fear not, here am I, Peter," you know. And so he jumped out impulsively and was just blowing it, to say the least. Now Moses here, I believe Moses' heart was right, his attitude was right, but it wasn't God's timing. So it kind of blew up in his face, but it was God's purposes being fulfilled. And so Moses had to flee. What a humbling experience for this Moses. He buried one Egyptian. God wanted him to bury the whole army of Pharaoh in the Red Sea. And that's what would happen when he was going to be empowered by God. Now in Acts chapter 7, verse 25, again, good old Stephen in his sermon tells us that Moses had thought that the children of Israel would know that he was the one who would deliver them. Stephen says, "For he thought that they would be the one to deliver." Moses thought, "Surely they know, you know, surely they know me." When the two were striving, and Moses says, "Hey, what are you doing, your brethren?" And they said, "Who made you a prince or ruler over you?" Moses probably was, you know, shocked. What do you mean, who am I? "I'm Moses. Haven't you read about me? I'm the great deliverer." "No, we haven't read about you, and I don't even know who you are." And he thought that his brother would recognize him. This wasn't God's timing. They didn't recognize him, and as a result, he had to flee to the wilderness of Midian. Verse 15. Now also in Hebrews 11:27, you might want to check it out, it says that when Moses fled from Pharaoh, we just read it, he fled by faith. By faith he fled from the wrath of Pharaoh. So I believe it was kind of a mixture. He heard Pharaoh was going to take his life, and so there was a mixture running in his body of faith and fear. Kind of a thing where faith was prominent, but a little of fear, you know, "Oh no, I've got to get out of here." But, you know, that faith was just in his mind as he was that driving force of believing that God would take care of him. He's kind of a picture almost like of Jacob, when Jacob had to run from the wrath of his brother Esau into a strange land. Where did Jacob run to? He ran to Paddan Aram, and he sat down by a well. And even as Moses sits down by a well, meets, you know, the woman he's going to marry, Jacob went and found Rachel, you know the whole story. And so it's almost like a picture of Jacob as he ran. He sat down by the well. Now Midian is in the Sinai Peninsula. It's all wilderness area. It's along the eastern shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. It's way down there, and it's just desolate, just sand, just nothing. Now the Midianites were descendant also of Abraham through Abraham's wife Keturah. This was the wife Abraham married after Sarah had died. They were kind of nomadic people. They were kind of like Bedouins that just traveled around, lived in the wilderness of Midian. They were the descendants also of Abraham. They were God-fearing people. They were monotheistic. They worshiped one God. And so God had provided for Moses, running for his life, a beautiful place to go, a place where he could fellowship even with God-fearing people. And Jethro, who was the leader in the area, the prince of Midian, he was actually the priest of Midian. He was actually a God-fearing person and probably could share with Moses a lot of the wisdom and the things of God. And so he was fleeing. Verse 16, let's get on with the story. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water, and they filled the troughs of water for their father's flock. As it told us in verse 15, Moses was sitting by this well where these girls were coming to draw water. And the shepherds came, verse 17, and they drove them away. But Moses stood up and he helped them and watered their flocks. Now, when these 7 daughters of Jethro, the priest of Midian, would come to water their flocks, the other shepherd boys and the other shepherd fellows in the area, they would, you know, wait, hold back, let the girls draw the water, and then they'd come and chase them off, and they'd let their sheep drink the water. And so the girls had to go and fill this trough over and over for all the shepherds in the area. After they'd watered all these guys' sheep, then they had to draw it again for their own sheep and split, you know, at the end. Now Moses, you know, rolls up his sleeves and flexes his muscles a little bit. He's 40 years old, but still very well built and good looking, you know. And he comes running up to this defense of these 7 young girls. He draws the water and he tells these other characters to wait their turn until these girls had watered their sheep. And so when they had watered their sheep, when they came to Reuel, which was also called Jethro, their father, and this name Reuel is an interesting name. It means a friend of God. They came to their father and he said, how is it that you're come so soon today? You know, usually you got to water everybody's sheep and you got back pretty quick today. And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flocks. And he said unto his daughters, where is he? Why is it you have not? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. I like old Reuel here. He's a neat guy. How come you got home so quick today? They say, well, this Egyptian guy, you know. I mean, Egyptians just don't hang out in the desert of Midian. This Egyptian guy came cruising along and, you know, got our sheep watered and everything. He said, well, why did you leave him standing out there? Go get him. Invite him home. Tell him to come kick back and have some food for a while here. And one of the cultures in the Middle East, of course, even more prominent then than it is now, was hospitality. They'd leave their doors open, a stranger come walk in, you know, go to the icebox, help himself. I think it's a right-on policy. And they would just share, and it was a very hospitable kind of a culture. So he says, invite him in, bring him in, you know, let's have him in for eats and so forth. And so Moses, it says, was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. And so Moses was content to dwell, and he got himself there a wife. Now Zipporah, we'll get into her more as the life of Moses goes on. It seems as though that she caused problems for Moses. She was probably attracted to him at first of all by his strength, you know, he watered their sheep for him, and she thought, well, this guy's all right. And so he married Zipporah, but Zipporah, it seems as though, could care very little for the things of God and became kind of a thorn in the side of Moses. It's so important for Christians to marry Christians. If you're a spiritual-minded person, marry a spiritual Christian. Not only is it important for Christians to marry Christians, but it's important that if you really want to live a full-on life for Jesus Christ, make sure the person you marry is not only a Christian, but a dedicated, committed Christian who also wants to serve the Lord, because there's a lot of flaky, carnal Christians running around. And you just don't meet somebody and say, are you born again? Oh, yeah, I'm born again. Will you marry me? Oh, I noticed you have a Bible in your bottom shelf down there. Will you marry me? Make sure that they're committed. If you feel God's going to call you to a ministry someday, make sure that that person you're going to marry also wants to be a minister, also wants to give his life in service. And so Zipporah became kind of a thorn in Moses' side as the years went on. She had to be set back by Moses. The most important time in his life, when he was going on his way to Egypt to deliver the people of Israel, he had a big argument with her and had to send her home to her dad. What a bummer. Could have used her there for support, you know, and has to send her home to her father. So be careful who you marry. And so she bore to him, verse 22, a son and called his name Gershom, For he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land, and the name Gershom means stranger. And also in the 18th chapter of Exodus, verse 4, Moses had another son by Zipporah, and his name was Eleazar, and that means, my God is help. And so he had two sons there when he was in Midian, before he went to deliver the children of Israel. One was called Gershom, one was called Eleazar, stranger, because he was a stranger in the strange land. One meant, my God is help. Moses, those 4 years, kept his faith and his trust in God and knew that God was going to help him and was God was going to deliver him. And so it says that it came to pass, verse 23, that in the process of time, this is about 40 years as we're going to enter into the last 80 years of Moses' life, that the king of Egypt died and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of their bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect or took notice unto them. God does not forget his people. And I believe that when his people of God are going through trials and going through testings and going through hard times, that not only does God know what they're going through, but they become the special object of God's care and God's concern. Those of you that have children know what it's like to have a child that's sick. And maybe you've got 4 kids and all of them are healthy except for one. That one child becomes the object of your special care and your special concern, where you pamper that child and you take care of that child and you hold them and caress them and love them and keep them near to you. And so this is the same way God works in us. And so often when we're going through testings and trials, it's the time when God is really nearer than when we know. God is there and he's present and he sees and he doesn't forget. It tells us here so beautifully that God, verse 24, heard, he remembered, verse 25, he looked upon them and he took note, verse 25, respect unto them. God heard, God remembered, God looked, and God took notice. How many times have you in a time of testing or trial thought, oh, surely God has forgotten me? You know, God seems so far off and so impersonal. And the trials that you're going through seem so real. God seems so unable to help. And, you know, you're just about ready to go under and you think God has forsaken and God's forgotten you. Not so. God hasn't failed you. God is there. He knows your cries. He sees your troubles. He knows your weakness and he takes note. And thus God had not forgot his covenant, verse 24, that he made with Abraham, Genesis 15. God says, they shall go through this time, but I will deliver them. Now God's purposes were being accomplished. Moses now was 80 years old. Now put yourself in closing here in Moses' place. He'd been schooled in all that Egypt had to offer. He'd had all the training and all the learning and all the schooling. Felt God leading him to deliver the people of Israel and tried and miserably failed. He tried to relieve their misery and it brought upon him his own misery. But this was the program of God. God was building a man and building character. God had to send him to a place where he could learn things that he couldn't learn in the schools of Egypt. You know, God doesn't really need our education so often to use us, though it's good. God doesn't need our wisdom and our abilities. God wants to put us in a place where he can teach us spiritual lessons and things that we can learn nowhere else. And so Moses had gotten everything Egypt had to offer. Now he had to learn there are certain things that only a time of being alone, a time of being in distress, a time of complete humility and failure. As we see next week, not only was he there in the wilderness and got to be good friends with Jethro, his father-in-law, but Jethro sent him out on a very menial task to become just a shepherd. You would think he'd say, Moses, you've been to school in Egypt. Why don't you take over and be the leader? He says, no, take these sheep and go out on the other side of Moab and find him some pasture. What humility Moses had to enter into. All his dreams and all his ambitions seemingly dashed and had to flee into a place where it seemed as though all the things he wanted to do for God were the farthest thing as far as being possible. He was thinking out in the wilderness, I'm sure, oh, how can I ever fulfill my desire to deliver the people of Israel? I'm sitting out here herding sheep in the desert. Thinking probably that he'd been forsaken by God, but all the time it was God's program. God was shaping and molding and developing character in Moses. He had to learn things that he couldn't learn anywhere else there at that time of becoming nothing, that time of humility, that time of God working in him. And it's a beautiful picture of that, first of all, Moses, in order for him to grow strong and to really sprout forth his leaves and for his life to be fruitful, his roots had to go, first of all, deep. You know, I'm not very much for horticulture, for houseplants and stuff, but a lot of you know what the houseplant, Creeping Charlie is. Call it Creeping George or whatever you want, I don't. But you know one thing about a Creeping Charlie, it's probably true with many other plants, that if you really want it to thicken and to become healthy and strong, you kind of clip them back. You can even just take and kind of pluck off the leaves so that they'll thicken at the base and become more healthy and strong. And it's kind of like a picture of the processes of God so often in our life, that God so often has to almost put us back a notch, cut off some of the little things and prune off some of the little areas in order that our roots can go deeper so that when we break forth and we bud forth, that we can be a thicker and healthier and stronger plant rather than just being one string beam pole, you know, with a little tiny root. God doesn't want to see a whole lot of action up here. He wants to see some action underneath there, those roots going deep. You know, we want to see the fruit and the leaves and everything coming out. But what's important is the roots. And so Moses had to spring downward before he can sprout upward. And so these 40 years were a process of God whereby his roots were getting deep into God's soil. And God was shaping and molding his character so that for those last 40 years, God could take him and use him in a mighty way. His roots had to become deep. Now you might be in that same position where you feel like all your ambitions have been dashed and the things that you really wanted to do for God have all fallen apart. You don't need to be discouraged. Moses spent 40 years in the wilderness. You know, some of them have been Christian for 3 years and we're dying because we're not, you know, doing a great thing for God or something. You're doing more for God than you realize. Don't be discouraged. God is just working in you. He's not finished yet. Allow your roots to go deep so that you can sprout up high. If you don't go deep, you can't go high. You know, when we were in Israel, it seems as though they have a lot more high-rise, definitely, than we have in San Bernardino area. You go down to LA and they've got the large high-rise buildings. But you know, when you build a large high-rise apartment or hotel, you have to dig those things deep. We stayed in Jerusalem and we stayed in a hotel. We were on the 18th floor. And that was about in the middle of the place. It went way up. And right next to us, they were building another one and they'd only had the hole dug. And believe me, that hole looked like it was about 18 stories deep. Huge hole. And you have to go deep if you want to go high. A lot of us just want to start at ground level and go up, you know, let's get it on, Lord. And this process of digging down and getting strong and laying the foundation, we just want to hurry by. This was God's preparatory years for the life of Moses, preparing him for the ministry he was going to call him. The deliverer, the greatest leader in all human history, Moses. And here he is out herding sheep in the wilderness. But God was prepping his heart and preparing him, a man of faith. Not getting discouraged, but trusting God, and that God would come in his perfect time, and in the power of his Spirit, he would be used of God to deliver his people. And I believe that God wants to use us. Even as he used Moses, God wants to use us. And God is working in our lives right now to fulfill his purposes, to make us strong, to make us what he wants us to be. Let's pray.